stand in front of one. Just stand there for a minute and let the scale happen to you. The Republic P-47 Thunderbolt at the National Museum of the United States Air Force in Dayton, Ohio, sits in the World War II gallery like it owns the room. Because it does. The fuselage is nearly circular in cross-section. The cowling is wide enough that you could almost park a riding lawnmower inside it. The landing gear is extraordinarily tall, comically tall almost, because it has to be to keep that four-bladed propeller off the ground. And when you take it all in, when you let the sheer mass of the thing register, you understand immediately why the men who flew it gave it the name they did. The Jug. I'm Taildragger, and this is The Hangar on Radio Hangar. Today we are talking about the most produced American fighter of the Second World War and one of the most underappreciated airplanes ever to turn a propeller. Before we get into it, today's show is brought to you by AviationSoul.com. Aviation Challenge coins for every milestone in flight. First solo, private pilot, instrument rating, all the way up. If you've earned it, they've got a coin for it. Every coin tells a story. Check them out at AviationSoul.com. The story of the Thunderbolt begins with a man who thought big. Alexander Cardvelli was born in Tbilisi, in what is now the country of Georgia. He emigrated to the United States in the 1920s and ended up at Seversky Aircraft Corporation, which eventually became Republic Aviation on Long Island in New York. Cardvelli was an aeronautical engineer of genuine, restless genius. When the Army Air Corps came to him in the late 1930s asking for a high-altitude interceptor, he did not reach for the smallest engine that would do the job. He reached for the biggest one available. The Pratt & Whitney R-2800 Double Wasp, 18 cylinders arranged in two rows, 2,000 horsepower on a good day. And more than that, when the water injection system was feeding it, the most powerful air-cooled radial engine in American production. Now here's where it gets interesting. To make that engine breathe at altitude, you needed a turbo supercharger. And a turbo supercharger is not a small piece of equipment. Cardvelli designed his to mount in the rear fuselage, behind the cockpit, connected to the engine by a long series of ducting that ran under the pilot's seat and along the fuselage walls. All of that machinery needed room. So the fuselage had to be big. And a big fuselage needed a big wing. And a powerful engine in the nose needed a long propeller to pull all of it through the air. And a long propeller on a single-engine fighter meant the landing gear had to be tall enough to keep those prop tips off the tarmac. By the time the design was finished, Republic had a fighter that weighed just over 7 tons when loaded for combat. For comparison, a fully loaded Supermarine Spitfire came in at roughly 3 tons. The Thunderbolt was more than twice as heavy. The first reaction from the people who saw it was not encouraging. There is a story, maybe apocryphal, but too good to leave out, of a Royal Air Force officer, seeing a P-47 for the first time at an airfield in England and asking whether he could hide behind it. British understatement at its finest, but the sentiment was genuine. This thing looked like a flying barrel. Pilots who had been flying slender, graceful machines were not sure what to make of it. What they discovered once they got it into the air and started pushing it was this. The Jug could dive like nothing else in the sky. In a dive, the P-47 would accelerate past 500 miles per hour, and in that high-speed regime, the controls stayed firm and the airplane felt planted rather than floaty. Experienced Thunderbolt pilots learned to fight from altitude, climb up, get an energy advantage, make a fast slashing pass, and if the Germans turned to give chase, push the nose down and run. No fighter in the Luftwaffe could match a diving Thunderbolt. The flip side was honest too. At low altitude in a slow-turning fight against a Focke-Wulf 190 or a Messerschmitt 109, the Thunderbolt was at a disadvantage. It did not turn like a Spitfire. Pilots who forgot that and tried to outmaneuver a German fighter at low speed paid for the lesson badly. Pilots who remembered that the airplane's strengths lived up high and going fast did very well indeed. And then there was the thing that made pilots love the Jug in a way that went past tactical preference into something more personal. The Thunderbolt could absorb punishment that would have killed a lesser airplane, and it would still bring you home. Hub Zemke commanded the 56th Fighter Group out of England. He was from Montana, a disciplined and demanding combat leader who understood the P-47 intuitively. He called his unit the Wolfpack, and he built them from scratch into the top-scoring fighter group in the 8th Air Force. Zemke's tactics were straightforward: stay high, use the speed, make energy attacks, do not get dragged down into the weeds in a slow-turning fight, work the airplane's strengths and come home. By the time the war was over, the 56th had destroyed more than 900 enemy aircraft in the air. No other fighter group in the 8th Air Force matched that number. One of Zemke's pilots was Francis Gabreski. His family had come over from Poland. He learned to fly in the Army Air Corps, was stationed at Pearl Harbor on December 7, 1941, though he was not in the air that morning. He eventually made it to England and the 56th Fighter Group, and he found his airplane in the P-47. By the end of his first combat tour, Gabreski had 28 confirmed aerial victories, making him the top American ace in the European theater of the war. He could have gone home. He probably should have gone home. He flew one more mission. In July of 1944, on a strafing pass over a German airfield, he brought his aircraft in too low and the propellers struck the ground. He belly landed in Germany and spent the rest of the war in a prison camp. He survived that too. He came home and flew in Korea, where he added 6.5 more victories in a jet. Some pilots carry that kind of luck. Or maybe it was not luck, maybe it was the caliber of man that the Army Air Corps was producing in those years. Robert Johnson was 22 years old and from Oklahoma when he joined the 56th Fighter Group in the summer of 1943. On one mission over Germany, a Focke Wulf 190 latched onto his P-47 and worked it over hard. The hydraulic system was shot out, the canopy was jammed shut. He could not open it, he could not bail out, the oxygen was gone, the controls responded poorly, the airplane was a wreck in the air. It was still flying. The German pilot, apparently out of ammunition after pouring everything he had into the Thunderbolt, pulled alongside Johnson's aircraft and looked across at the battered American airplane. Then he saluted, and he turned for home. Johnson nursed that aircraft back to England. He got the wheels down because the hydraulics, damaged as they were, still managed to get the gear out. When the ground crew counted the hits, they found more than 200 bullet holes in the airplane. He was back in the cockpit within a week. That was the jug. It would bring you home. The Thunderbolt's mission evolved as the war did. Early on, it served as high-altitude escort for the bombers of the 8th Air Force, protecting the flying fortresses and liberators as far as its range allowed. The early range limitations were real. Without drop tanks, the P-47 could not follow the big bombers all the way to their targets deep in Germany, and the crews who flew those long-range missions to places like Schweinfurt knew that their fighter cover would fall away before the worst part of the trip began. That problem improved over time as larger fuel tanks came online and the airplane's capabilities grew. But after the Normandy invasion, when the war moved to the ground in France and Belgium, the Thunderbolt found its second purpose. The 9th Air Force turned the P-47 into a close air support weapon of considerable effectiveness. 8.50 caliber machine guns were only the beginning. The airplane could carry bombs under the wings, rockets on rail launchers, napalm, flying at low altitude over the road networks and rail lines of occupied Europe. Thunderbolts cut supply lines, knocked out bridges, destroyed fuel depots, and hunted German armor. In that role, flying into the teeth of German anti-aircraft fire day after day at low altitude, the airplane's ability to take hits and keep flying was not just a feature. It was the reason pilots got to see their families again. Total production, approximately 15,600 aircraft, more than any other American fighter of the war. The P-47 served in every theater, over Germany with the 8th Air Force, across France with the 9th. In the Pacific with the 7th and 20th Air Forces flying long patrols out of Saipan and Iwo Jima, over the jungles of Burma with the 10th Air Force. Wherever there was a war being fought from the air, somebody put Thunderbolts into it, now. Back to Dayton. Back to that airplane on the museum floor. The aircraft at the National Museum of the United States Air Force is a P-47D, finished in the markings of the 56th Fighter Group. The D model introduced what was called the bubble canopy, a single-piece blown plexiglass dome that replaced the earlier framed configuration pilots had called the Razorback. The Razorback cut off the pilot's rearward view significantly. With the bubble canopy, a Thunderbolt pilot could see all the way around and behind him. That was not a cosmetic improvement. Men had died because they could not see what was closing from behind. The bubble canopy addressed that, and it came along at a point in the war when the Luftwaffe, though declining, was still capable of killing you if you were not paying attention. Look at the propeller blades. 4 of them, and each one is nearly as wide as your shoulders at the base. Look at the cowling. Imagine that R2800 coming to life on a cold morning at a grass airfield in Suffolk. The ground crews said you could hear it across the whole base, probably across the countryside for miles. There is armor plate behind the cockpit seat, thick steel, deliberately placed to stop rounds coming from behind. Between the engine mass, up front, the firewall, the structure of the airplane, and that armor plate, a Thunderbolt pilot had layers of protection that other fighters of that period simply could not offer. Cartvelli thought about the man in the seat. He built that thinking into the design. That was his gift to the men who flew his airplane. Now, if you're making the trip to Dayton, and you should make the trip to Dayton because the National Museum of the United States Air Force is free to visit and is one of the finest aviation museums anywhere in the world. Take your time in the World War II gallery. Do not rush the Thunderbolt. Stand there long enough to let the scale of it settle into you. Read the placard, think about Zemke and the Wolfpack. Think about Gabreski and his 28 victories and the one strafing pass that took him out of the war. Think about Johnson coming home across the channel with 200 holes in his airplane and a German pilot riding alongside him who had nothing left to shoot. There are still Thunderbolts flying today. You'll hear one coming before you see it, that big radial with the four-blade prop making a sound that has weight to it. When one makes a low pass at an air show, you feel it in your chest before it clears the crowd line. There's mass to it, purpose, the sound of something serious doing exactly what it was designed to do. The mighty 8th Air Force Museum in Savannah, Georgia has one. The American Air Museum at Duxford in England has one. A handful of Warbird operators have brought examples back to airworthy condition and keep flying them, keep showing them to people who never got the chance to see one when they were everywhere.
Every one of those airplanes is carrying something. The weight of the men who flew them. The weight of what they were asked to do. And the evidence, still visible in some airframes if you know where to look, of what they survived. Go find one. Stand next to it. Then ask yourself what it must have been like to climb into that cockpit at 20 years old, knowing that somewhere over Germany there was a Focke Wulf with your name on it, and knowing at the same time that the machine underneath you had brought men home from worse. That was the jug. That was what Republic Aviation gave them. Sources today come from Roger Freeman's The Mighty 8th War Manual and the Oral History and Unit History Collections at the National Museum of the United States Air Force in Dayton. You can find more at radiohangar.com. I'm Taildragger. The hangar is always open.